All right, I want to welcome those who are listening to the podcast. This is lesson number 5. And tonight we're going to be talking about the Grecian Empire. We're going to examine the time period when the Greeks ruled the known world. Now, by way of a very brief review, before we begin our look at this critical time period between the close of the Hebrew Scriptures and the opening of the New Testament, I want to remind you of where we have been so far. Since the creation of the world, the rise of human civilization, until the coming of Jesus the Messiah, there were only 5 world empires. Everyone will tell you this. Sociologists, secular historians, and those like I who believe the Bible. The world had 5 empires from the rise of human civilization to the coming of Christ. And that's all. You say, well, what is an empire? Well, there were countries and cities that would go to war, but a country would attack another country and then pull back. A city might attack another city and then pull back. An empire was a country that would attack another country and stay, raise taxes, and subjugate the people. The world's first empire was the Assyrian Empire. You read about the rise of the Assyrian Empire in the book of Chronicles because it is the Assyrians who invade Israel and wipe out the 10 tribes of the northern kingdom and were about to wipe out the 2 tribes of the southern kingdom, Judah, until the Lord intervened. It's a great story you can read about in the Bible, Chronicles and Kings. The world's second empire is the Babylonian Empire. We looked at them in our study already. I showed you how the Babylonians conquered the Assyrians in 609 BC. And Babylon only ruled as a world empire for 70 years. Now, because you probably think to yourself, I don't know anything about the Assyrians. For heaven's sake, who are they? I just remind you that the capital of Assyria was Nineveh. And when you read the book of Jonah, you have God telling Jonah to go to the capital of the Assyrian Empire, those wicked Ninevites, the Assyrians, and to preach the goodness of Yahweh to them. And Jonah couldn't believe that wicked people could repent, so he ran from the call of God until the Lord captured him in the Mediterranean and sent him back to Nineveh. So that's Assyria. Babylon, you read about throughout the Old Testament. Nebuchadnezzar, the wicked king of Babylon who destroyed Jerusalem. And in one of our previous studies, I showed you how when he came, after he defeated the Assyrians, he came to Jerusalem and destroyed the southern kingdom of Judah, tore down the walls of Jerusalem, the temple of Jerusalem, gouged the eyes out of Zedekiah, the last king of Judah, right after he killed Zedekiah's son. So the last thing Zedekiah saw was his boys being murdered. Just a brutal man. That's the Babylonian Empire, but they only lasted 70 years because last week, as we saw in lesson number 4, God raised Cyrus, the Persian, called the Anointed One, Isaiah 45, verse 1. His name is mentioned by the prophet Isaiah. God raised up Cyrus and the Persians to conquer the Babylonians. God had told the prophet Jeremiah that Babylon would only last for 70 years. And sure enough, the Babylonian Empire only lasted for 70 years. So the Persian Empire comes to the throne. And last week I showed you the 10 Persian kings. In a Bible study that took a lot of time to prepare, and I delivered it, I know, very quickly. And tonight, we're going to come very close to the same amount of content as we did last week looking at the Persian Empire, because tonight we're going to focus in on the Grecian Empire. The Greeks defeated the Persians, and became the world's fourth empire. And then, in the coming weeks, I'll show you the Roman Empire. And at the end of this study, you'll see how the Romans were the ones who had defeated the Greeks, and they were the ones who were ruling the world when the Messiah was born. In the days of Caesar Augustus, a decree went out that all the world should be taxed, and so on. Well, that Caesar Augustus, I'll be telling you about him. He is the emperor of Rome. So my point to you is this. I've just given you the entire world's history prior to the coming of Christ, and that's what we're studying. Tonight, we get into the time period between the Testaments, between the close of your Old Testament and the opening of the New Testament. Most of what I'll be sharing with you tonight will not be found in the Scriptures except for one book, the book of Daniel. And the story that I said I would tell you tonight, my favorite story in terms of world history, I will share with you this evening, and it pertains to the book of Daniel and Alexander the Great. Because after Athens was destroyed by the Persian king Xerxes in 480 BC, we discussed it last week. Xerxes, by the way, king of Persia, is the king who married Esther. And if you're in the room looking at the PowerPoint slides that are on the screen, you see this awful-looking picture of what Hollywood portrays King Xerxes to have looked like. This is from the film 300. What's interesting is when you read the Greek historians, who are the ones who defeated the Persians, what's the old saying? History is written by the victors. The Greeks always made the Persians look really, really, really bad, including Xerxes' wife of Esther. He burned Athens to the ground, and the Greeks never forgave him. By the time the Persian Empire reaches its height of influence, the map that you're looking at here, all that's covered in red, from India to the east, to Greece in the west, that is a huge swath of land. Persia ruled it. It's the Persian Empire. And as I said, Persia attacked Greece because Greece had come to what we call Turkey. Back then it was called Ionia or Lydia. And there were some Greeks who were living there who had revolted against paying taxes to the Persian Empire. And the Greeks helped their fellow brothers living in Ionia to revolt. And Darius and Xerxes said, okay, we're going to punish Greece. So they marched on Greece. Darius did in 490 and Xerxes did in 480. And as I shared with you last week, they burned Athens to the ground and they almost conquered Greece, except for the most important naval battle in the history of the world, the Battle of Salamis in 480, the Persians lost. And as I said last week, and I'll repeat it again, had they won that naval battle, Xerxes was watching Athens burn behind him, seated on his throne, looking at the Bay of Salamis south of Athens, and he saw his navy defeated, and he was so discouraged, he took his army and walked home. Had Persia won that battle, you'd be speaking Farsi tonight, not English, because the West would have been East. Okay? So that's why even today at the Naval Academy, they study the Battle of Salamis. Now here is a picture of Greece. When the Persians were defeated in 480 at the Battle of Salamis, and Xerxes marched his army back across the north to the Persian Empire, crossing the Hellespont, and went back to Persia, you still have Greece, but their major city, Athens, is burned to the ground. If you ever go tour Athens, everything that you see is built after 480 BC. The Parthenon, everything that you see was built after that. This is Greece after the Battle of Salamis in 480 BC. For the next 150 years, the Greeks hated the Persians. The Persians continued to rule the known world. They kind of left Greece alone. But the fire of Athens was nothing compared to the fire in the hearts of the Greek people. It would be like Washington, D.C. being burned to the ground by the Chinese. And 100 years later, we here in America still resent the Chinese for burning our capital. That's what happened to the Greeks for nearly a century and a half, until a young man decided to take an army of Greeks to Persia and smack them in the mouth. His name was Alexander II of Macedon. You know him as Alexander the Great. And he is the one who eventually defeated the Persian Empire and gave rise to the Greek Empire. And that is our study tonight. Let's begin. Take your appendix, because we're going to look at the appendix first, and then I'll come back to lesson number 5 and very quickly show you the 5 major points. I want to talk to you about Alexander the Great. And I want to show you some things in the slides that will illuminate and illustrate your handout. I would again encourage you to listen to what I'm saying orally. You can read, if you can multitask, you can read what I've printed, but everything I'll be telling you is on the printed page. But if you listen to me and see the pictures, and if you're listening to the podcast, you'll still get the content of the notes because I'm going through it, but I'll be paraphrasing some things to make it as interesting as possible. Alexander, there's a typo there, the second of Macedon, commonly known as Alexander the Great, was born July of 356 BC. His father was King Philip of Macedon. King Philip lived for 46 years before he died. He lived from 382 to 336. And let me tell you where Macedon is, because when I use the word Macedon, you probably like, where is that? I don't even know what it is. Well, it's just north of Greece, right here in the pink. The Greeks, back in the 5th century, weren't a cohesive country. They were regions and particularly cities that were self-governed and self-ruled. Thessaly, Athens, Sparta, Corinth, and so on. Macedon was a region ruled by King Philip. He was a Macedonian. Alexander's mother, however, was not a Macedonian. She was from the western coast of Greece, from a place called Epirus. Here's the interesting thing about Alexander's father and mother. Alexander's father had many wives. He had several Macedonian wives. And King Philip had many sons. But the only son born to Olympias was Alexander. And an amazing thing happened to Olympias, the mother of Alexander. She believed with all her heart on the night she became pregnant with Alexander that a lightning bolt struck her womb. Mount Olympus was just to the south of Macedon and just to the north of Athens. Now, Mount Olympus can be seen from where King Philip ruled and from where the king of Athens ruled. Olympus was the place that the Greeks believed the 12 Olympic gods lived. Most Greeks couldn't see the top of Olympus because it was enshrouded with a cloud most of the time. And so there was this mystical belief that the gods lived at the top. Here is a picture of where Mount Olympus is located on a modern map today. Athens is here to the south. There is the mountain, and Macedon is up here. Mount Olympus is halfway between Macedon, where King Philip ruled, and Athens, which had been burned to the ground by the Persians. These are the names of the 12 gods. Zeus was the head god. Then you've got Hera, Athena, Apollo, Poseidon, Ares, Artemis. Artemis is key. She is the goddess of war and fertility. You have Demeter, Aphrodite, Dionysus is the goddess of wine, Hermes, the messenger god. If you ever studied Greek mythology or Latin mythology in school, you're very familiar with these 12 Olympian gods. Now, Zeus was the god who lived on Olympus, who kept everybody in line. He was the father god, and he is pictured as holding a lightning bolt in his hands. So when Olympias believed that she was struck with lightning in her womb, what does that say to you in terms of Olympias' thinking? Her child is the son of Zeus. Now here's what's fascinating about the birth of Alexander the Great. When Alexander the Great was born on July the 21st, 356 BC, the temple of Artemis, the goddess of fertility and war, burned to the ground the night that Alexander was born. This temple, and by the way, several of you have been with us, it's located, the remains of it are located in western Turkey, the city of Ephesus. That's where the city of Ephesus is today. It's the same Ephesus that Paul writes his letter to the Ephesians. And I don't have time tonight. I've written a great deal on the temple of Artemis in Ephesus. You'll never understand 1 and 2 Timothy and the book of Ephesians until you understand Artemis worship in Ephesus. Because the Greeks would build temples to the 12 Olympian gods to pray for their blessings over whatever area the gods ruled. So men would go to the temple of Artemis to pray for blessings for the hunt, and women would pray to Artemis at the temple for their pregnancies. On the night Alexander was born, this temple burned to the ground, and it was one of the ancient wonders of the world. In fact, when Croesus, the richest man who's ever lived, in fact, there's a phrase still today, I'm going to ask a question of you. Have you ever heard the phrase, rich as Croesus? If you have, lift your hand. Wow, okay, just a couple of you. A little tidbit, back in the 1930s, you couldn't get into Harvard unless you answered the question, rich as blank, fill in the blank. It just goes to show you that Americans used to study what I'm teaching you, but the last couple of generations never learned it. Croesus built the temple of Artemis, and he put gold coins into the foundation. It was considered one of the ancient wonders of the world. It was magnificent, and it burned to the ground. Let me tell you how it burned to the ground. A man by the name of Herostratus went to the temple the night of July the 21st, 356, and he set fire to the wooden roof beams. And do you know why? He wanted to seek fame at any cost. So he's going to burn down one of the wonders of the world so he would be famous. There's an English term called Herostratic fame, which comes from this event. And basically, it would be like the kids who fired their guns at Columbine High School. They wanted Herostratic fame. They wanted to be famous no matter the cost, even if it meant murder. When the temple burned to the ground, the Ephesians sentenced Herostratus to death, and they forbade anyone from even mentioning his name. But a legend began to grow among the Greeks who worshiped Artemis that the reason the temple burned down the night Alexander was born is because Alexander was the son of Zeus and Artemis was coming to attend his birth. This is the rise, the beginning, if you will, of Alexander the Great, the man who would defeat the Persians. As a young boy, King Philip sent his son Alexander to Athens to be trained by the Greek philosopher Aristotle. So Alexander received the greatest education available to mankind in his day. The promise that King Philip made to Aristotle for training his son in the arts and philosophy was that he, King Philip of Macedon, would rebuild Aristotle's hometown, which had been destroyed in a war that King Philip had started with that town. At the age of 10, it is said by a Greek historian that Alexander was introduced to a black stallion that his father Philip had purchased from a horse trader, that the soldiers of Philip, King Philip, tried to get on that horse and they couldn't control it. Alexander observed this at the age of 10, walked into the arena, and as an ancient horse whisperer, calmed the black stallion, tamed it, hopped on its back, and rode it. Alexander would ride the horse he named Bucephalus as he conquered the Persian Empire. When he eventually made it to India and his horse died of old age, he built a city in honor of his horse and named it Bucephalus. At the age of 13, Alexander, riding Bucephalus, joined the army of his father, King Philip of Macedon. And what happened during the time that Alexander served as a soldier under his father is that King Philip of Macedon and his army went to war against other Greek states and other Greek regions, conquered them, and then said this, "We're not your enemy, we're brothers. Let's make an alliance. Let's make a league." So Philip of Macedon is known for creating what's called the Corinthian League. There is no way the Greeks ever could have defeated the mighty Persians unless Philip of Macedon and his army had coalesced all of the independent Greek states and regions together into a league, into an alliance. Now, in ancient days, it was called the Hellenic Alliance. Most modern historians today call it the Corinthian League. Helena is the ancient word for Greece. Helen of Troy and so on. It goes back to how the Greeks got their start. So it's an important word because I'll be talking about the world being Hellenized in the next few weeks. And all that means is, as Alexander conquers the world, he brings Greek language, Greek customs, and Greek traditions to the countries he conquers. That's called Hellenization. Okay? Basically, in my opinion, it's God preparing the world for the coming of the Messiah. Because by the time Jesus is born in Bethlehem of Judea, the entire world speaks Koine Greek, the common language of Greek. So it's really easy for the gospel to be shared around the world when everybody speaks Greek. Let's go on. In the summer of 336, King Philip is assassinated. And let me tell you about that assassination. Alexander takes the throne when his father is assassinated, but there is the belief among many that Alexander killed his own father. And let me tell you the story. After the Corinthian League is formed, King Philip turns his gaze toward Persia. He's ready to attack. He's got all of the Greek cities on his side except for one, the city of Sparta. Everybody else has said, we're up to it. Let's go. We're going to go attack Persia. Why? Because they'd burned Athens to the ground. So he's getting his army ready, trained, equipped, and he's back in Macedon and he's at a banquet. And a discussion comes up as to who will be king after Philip. And Philip and another person at the table discuss a son of Philip that is pure Macedonian as the one who should be king. And here's Alexander, who's been told all his life by his mother, you are the son of Zeus. Artemis was here when you were born. You are a legend. Alexander is overhearing the discussion that he will not be king when his father dies. And he gets angry. In fact, I want to read from the Greek historian Plutarch. He writes what happens. This conversation, it's in your notes, bottom of Appendix 5. So irritated Alexander that throwing one of the cups at his head, he said, you villain, what am I, a bastard? Then Philip, taking Alice's part, that's the other guy that was discussing who should be king, and it's not Alexander, rose up and would have run his son through, meaning he would have pierced his son Alexander with a sword. But by good fortune for them both, either over his hasty rage at the anger of his son or the wine that had made him drunk, Philip had his foot slip, so that he fell down on the floor, at which Alexander reproachfully insulted him, saying, see there? The man who makes preparations to pass out of Europe into Asia, overturned in passing from one seat to another, mocking his own father. He fled that night with his mother Olympias. 6 months later, he returned because a family friend had mediated between an angry son Alexander and a father, Philip, who'd been shamed by the words of his own son. A mediation took place. Alexander and Olympias came back, and in the summer of 336, Philip was assassinated by Pausanias. But then, immediately, two bodyguards of Alexander, friends of Alexander, killed the assassin of Philip. And Alexander was named head of the Corinthian League on the spot. And many historians since have said that Olympias and Alexander plotted to kill Philip so that Alexander could take the throne. He was 20 years old. This is a picture of the movie Alexander, which was made in 2004. Colin Farrell played Alexander. Alexander takes the throne at the age of 20. His father is now deceased. He is supreme commander of the Corinthian League. And here's what happens. Here is Athens on your map. Here is Sparta. This is the great Persian Empire. Remember how the Persians came here from the south of Asia and they marched on Greece to burn it to the ground under the leadership of Darius and Xerxes? Well, now, fast forward 150 years, 334 BC, 2 years after Alexander comes to the throne, here comes Alexander and his army marching the opposite direction to conquer Persia. It is an incredible journey. In 334, Alexander crossed the Hellespont into Asia. The Hellespont here on the map is that very narrow place between Europe and Asia, a very narrow strip of water. It took about 100 ships. They're called triremes. These are ships with oars to transport all of the Macedonian army onto Persian soil. And the Battle of Granicus River takes place. It was the beginning of a series of battles that eventually led to the crushing defeat of the Persian army. In 333 BC, Alexander conquers Turkey, what we call Turkey at the Battle of Issus, and Persia and Darius III, the king of Persia, flee Turkey, flee Lydia, Ionia, and they go back to South Asia. They go back to their capital. They don't want anything to do with Alexander. And Alexander chases them. But what happens in the chase is absolutely extraordinary. And we come to my favorite story of ancient history. Let me show you again. This is a map of Alexander's journey. He crosses the Hellespont. He has the Battle of Granicus right there. Other battles. Here's Issus right here. Asia Minor in your Bible. That is modern day Turkey. He conquers Asia Minor. Now notice, the Persian army under Darius III, the last of the 10 kings of Persia, they escape. They move south to Asia, to Persepolis, to Persia, where they're from. And Alexander, instead of chasing them, look what he does. He goes south to Egypt. People say, why? Why didn't he chase the Persian army immediately back to Persia? Because Alexander wanted to conquer Egypt. But to get to Egypt, he had to go through those nasty Jews who lived in Jerusalem, Judea, the land bridge between Europe and Africa. And Alexander didn't like the Jews because the entire time the Persian Empire ruled the known world, the Jews kind of liked the Persians. Remember the picture I showed you of King Cyrus, the first king of Persia? The Jews even today love Cyrus. They've made a coin with Donald Trump's visage over the top of Cyrus's visage. The Jews love the Persians, and Alexander knew that, and he was ticked. And so what's he going to do? He's going to come, and he's going to punish the Jews. So he marches his army south, going to Egypt, and he's going to take care of those Jews once and for all. But an amazing thing happened. When he arrives outside of Jerusalem, word had come to the high priest of the Jews that Alexander and his army was coming. Now, the story I'm about to tell you is told in the works of Josephus in Jewish Antiquities. I've given you the reference. A lot of historians say that it didn't happen. I believe it did happen. A lot of liberal historians say it didn't happen because they believe Daniel, the book of Daniel, wasn't written until after the Roman Empire had defeated the Greeks. I believe the book of Daniel is an ancient book written long before even the Greeks existed in terms of an empire. Here's what happened. And I'm going to quote from Josephus. Alexander and his army went to Jerusalem after having taken Gaza, and Jaddua, the high priest, had a warning from God that he received in a dream, in which he saw himself vested in a purple robe with his mitre, that he had the golden plate on which the name of God was engraved on his head. The high priest wore a golden plate across his forehead that basically said in Hebrew, "You alone are worthy." In his dream, accordingly, it was said to him, he went to meet Alexander in view of the temple. Right outside of Jerusalem, the temple could still be seen. This is what he was to do. And so he does it. Followed by the priests of Jerusalem, all of them clothed in fine linen, and by a multitude of citizens from Jerusalem, Jaddua, the high priest, marches out of the city and awaits for the coming of the king. When Alexander saw the high priest, Josephus says, he reverenced God and saluted Jaddua, while the Jews with one voice greeted Alexander. When Parmenio, one of the generals of Alexander, saw what Alexander did, he expressed surprise. He thought Alexander was coming to extract punishment on the Jews. What are you doing, giving reverence to their God? What are you doing, adoring the high priest? Now listen to this. His entire army had been told by Alexander himself they were coming to punish the Jews. Here's what Alexander said. I did not adore him, meaning the priest, but the God who hath honored him with this high priesthood. For I saw this very person, Jaddua the high priest, in a dream, in this very habit, that means these very clothes, when I was still in Macedonia, who, when I was considering with myself how I might obtain dominion of Asia, exhorted me to make no delay, but boldly to pass over the sea, promising that he would conduct my army and would give me the dominion over the Persians. With that, Alexander then gave the high priest his right hand, and he went into the temple, and he offered sacrifice to Yahweh, to God, according to the high priest's instruction, treating the whole priesthood of the Jews magnificently. Here's what happened. And this is said by the Jewish authorities as well. It is discounted by many, but I happen to believe it. Jaddua brings out from the temple the scroll of Daniel. And he unrolls the scroll before Alexander to what we would call Daniel chapter 7, verse 8. And he reads it for him and he says, Alexander, this scroll tells us about the Babylonians and the Persians and you, the Greeks. The Persians have had 10 kings. They're the 10 horns. But another little horn will rise up. You're the little horn. And you will totally extract the Persian kings from their roots. And this little horn is to have eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth speaking great things. You, Alexander, you are shown right here in the scroll of the prophet Daniel. You are going to defeat the mighty Persians. This is what they showed him. And according to Josephus, Alexander was prepared for that meeting with the dream he had while at Macedon. Now, you say, wait, why do you like that so much? Well, many of you know that we have missions in Africa among the Muslims. And it is absolutely fascinating to me how Muslims are prepared to meet Jesus. When our missionary Yakuba Sedu goes, in fact, I'll tell you, I won't be general, I'll be specific. We had a team that was with Yakuba a couple of years ago, and a team from Emmanuel. He dropped them off at the place that you guys bought. It's the home base for many missionaries. We built it. And they said, Yakuba, our team said, where are you going? He said, man, the Lord's impressed me. I need to go back to the village we were just in. And so the driver takes Yakuba. Our team said, we'll go with you. They said, no, you stay here. The driver takes Yakuba back. And Yakuba, when they're coming into the village, he says, stop. The driver stops. He says, just go up, wait for me. The Lord's told me to just stay here on this rock. Yakuba sits on that rock. Sits there for about 15 minutes, and there comes a man walking from the village. And he says to Yakuba when he arrives, You're him. And Yakuba says, I am him. Didn't know what he meant. The man said, Allah told me last night in a dream to walk out of the village at midday, and there would be a man sitting on a rock who would tell me how to know Allah. And Yakuba shared Christ with that man. And that man became a Christian. A preparation for meeting Christ through a dream. It's one of the reasons why I believe this story of Alexander is true. But we must go further. After Alexander bypassed Jerusalem, blessed them, he went on south to Egypt. The year is 331 B.C. It's taken him basically 3 years to get from here to here. He stays in Alexandria the longest, in Egypt the longest, because he founds the city of Alexandria. He names it after himself in 331 B.C. And you, after he stays, well, in fact, in Alexandria and builds the city, he then goes into Persia, to Babylon, and he enters the city of Babylon. And, of course, Babylon, you think about this, the place where the Babylonians ruled. Nebuchadnezzar built this place, where the Persians lived, where Daniel the prophet was taken. Alexander comes to Babylon and makes it his home. And then he begins to proceed to march against Darius III to defeat him. And let me show you something about the meeting of Darius III. He goes to Persepolis chasing him. And the Persian troops hear that Alexander is coming, and they're scared. So in an attempt to save their own lives, in 330 BC, they kill Darius III, their own king. And that's how the Persian Empire comes to an end. Alexander goes ahead after defeating Darius at Persepolis with his own men killing him. He goes to India, and he comes right to the border. The elephants of India scare the Greeks. They'd never seen anything like it before. And so the men beg Alexander. They haven't seen their wives and children for several years. They want to go back to Greece. He allows them to turn around and to go back, but Alexander stops at Babylon. And he dies there in June of 323. He is only 32 years of age, and he's only been on the throne a little over a decade. And he's conquered the known world. The old saying is, when Alexander conquered everything there was to be conquered, he sat down and wept because there were no more worlds to conquer. Some people say that he died of venereal disease. He had married several women on the way, several native women. Others say that he too was assassinated. He was poisoned. Nobody knows for sure. I don't have time to tell you that the body of Alexander was greatly revered. Greatly revered. And it is one of the world's great mysteries as to where it is buried. Some incredible stories of rulers looking for the body of Alexander. But that's how the Greek Empire came to power. Alexandria, built by Alexander himself. That's the story of the rise of the Grecian Empire. Now, very quickly, in the final 10 minutes, I need to show you what happened after he died. When Alexander the Great died in Babylon, and it's interesting, when we come to look at the Roman Empire and Julius Caesar, who was the last of the leaders of the Roman Republic, Julius Caesar so revered Alexander the Great that he was once found by his best friend weeping. Weeping. And his best friend asked him, "Why are you crying, Caesar?" He said, "Because I'm 30 and I've done nothing compared to Alexander." All of the great leaders of the world have looked to Alexander the Great. When he died, his best friends were the generals of his army. When I say his best friends, what I mean is his friends who grew up with him in Macedon. His friends who were trained by Aristotle. His friends that went to school with him. Seleucus, Ptolemy, Antigonus, Cassander. His generals divide the world that Alexander conquered among themselves. And in Roman numeral 2 of lesson number 5, I show you the four, in essence, regions or mini empires that are divided. Now, I want you to pay careful attention to what I'm about to show you. There's only two of these four empires that really count. The Seleucid Empire. Seleucus, the general, had a son who had a son, and all the sons of Seleucus are the kings of the Seleucid Empire. General Ptolemy got Egypt and Alexandria, and he had a son who had a son, who had a son and then daughters. All the children of Ptolemy ruled the Ptolemaic Empire, Greece. And by the way, Ptolemy the IV married a woman named Cleopatra. Ptolemy the V married another woman named Cleopatra. I mean, George Foreman had 7 sons. They were all named George. All the Ptolemies are either named Ptolemy or Cleopatra and will be coming to the story of Antony and Cleopatra. What you need to understand is this: Cleopatra's a Greek. She's a Greek ruler. These are Greeks. These are Greeks. These are Greeks. These are Greeks. And the Greeks end up turning on themselves because the Seleucids want Egypt. The Ptolemies, who are in Egypt, They want what the Seleucids have. I want to ask a question. Which country, which region is in the middle between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies? Israel. Israel. Israel is the land bridge. So there are great battles between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies on who controls the land bridge. And Judea is what it's called. We call it Israel. Judea is squeezed. Let me tell you what happens on the back of lesson number 5. The Egyptian Ptolemaic supremacy over Judea was first. The Ptolemies had Judea originally. But then the Seleucids attacked the Ptolemies. Now, this battle between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies is beautifully laid out in Daniel chapter 11. You read about it. How the king of the north attacks the king of the south. The king of the south attacks the king of the north. And you read that and you think, who is that? Who is that? The king of the north is Seleucus. The king of the south is Ptolemy. You say, who's writing this? From the perspective of Israel, the Seleucids are to the north and the Ptolemies are to the south. That's how you understand Daniel chapter 11. And Daniel is writing about this great battle for control of Judea, the history of the world. The Ptolemies loved Egypt because of Alexandria. It became one of the ancient wonders of the world, the lighthouse that guided people in. And as I shared with you, I think in lesson number 2, the Greeks in Alexandria, the Ptolemies who ruled, they charged anybody who wanted to trade with the continent of Africa. They charged them a tax. And it wasn't money, it was scrolls. You had to bring your scrolls from your homeland. And at the library in Alexandria that was established by the Greeks, the Ptolemies, you would leave your scrolls and scholars from all over the world would study in that library and they would make copies of your scroll, translating it into the Greek language. Then they'd give you a copy of the Greek scroll. They'd keep the original. And all of the great documents of the entire world were stored in the Library of Alexandria. And you took back to your home country a Greek scroll. How are you going to read it? You got to learn Greek. And this is how the world was Hellenized. This is how Greek became a common language. And the Seleucids now, man, they want Egypt. They want the Ptolemies. They want that rich land. They want Africa. And so they march. They march in 198 on the Ptolemies, and they end up taking over Judea. And now, we don't have time to talk about it tonight. This is our subject for next week. And I just want to give you a taste. I want to whet your appetite. It is absolutely incredible what happens. The Seleucid kings were wicked, wicked, wicked men. They were worshipers of Zeus. They were polygamist. They didn't like the Jewish way of living. And they demanded that the Jews start worshiping Zeus. So next week I will share with you how one of the Seleucid kings, his name is Antiochus Epiphanes. He said to everyone living in Jerusalem, you must call me Antiochus Epiphanes. You know what Epiphanes means? It means God manifested. I am your God. He was king of the Seleucids. He built in the temple a monument to Zeus. And he ordered the slaughter of a pig in Yahweh's temple. And he forced a priest by the name of Mattathias to eat pork. And Mattathias was so angry that he killed the Seleucid soldier that made him eat pork. And he founded the Maccabees. And next week, I'm going to show you the Maccabean revolt as the Jews went to war against the Greek Seleucids who controlled them. And let me show you, this is a picture of Mattathias. I love, by the way, next week before you come, you need to read the book of Maccabees, if you have it. You can go online and read 1 Maccabees, the story I'll be telling you in pictures. You can read about it there. This is intertestamental history. This is a book written between the testaments that tell you about the Maccabean revolt. It happened for 25 years, from 167 to 142, led by this man, Matthias. I love the sword in his right hand. He's a priest in Modiin. And when he kills the man, he says to the people, come follow me. We're going to throw off these wicked Greeks. How dare they establish a monument to Zeus in the temple of Yahweh? And so the fight for their livelihood and lives begins. They're called the Maccabees. And the Jewish explanation of why is because in Exodus chapter 11, verse 15, there's an acrostic in Hebrew. And I won't even attempt to pronounce it, but except for me, Kamacha Bielim Yahweh. And it's an acrostic, M-C-H-B-E, Maccabee, translated in English, who is like you among the heavenly gods, Lord or Yahweh. In other words, when the Maccabees went to attack the Greeks, they would shout this verse out, who is like you among the heavenly gods, Yahweh or Lord? And they would attack. They didn't want Zeus in their temple. This is the Maccabean revolt. And what's interesting, again, this is all next week. The Jews, believe it or not, won. Incredible. They defeated the mighty Seleucid Greeks. And when they defeated them, December of 164, and again, this is next week, I'll tell you more about it. They cleansed the temple and they lit the candelabra. It became known as Hanukkah. And so, if you ever wish a Jew happy Hanukkah, it's not Merry Christmas. It is the Jews' celebration of saving their lives from the pagan Greeks. And next week, I think you'll have a deeper appreciation for Hanukkah by the time that we're done. So, as I said, if you can, read Maccabees. I want to close by showing you two final things. Eventually, in 142 BC, the Greeks leave Judea because there's another enemy they're having to fight. They've had to fight the Jews and they lose. But there's another enemy coming from the west, and it's the Romans. Ooh, where did the Romans come from? Well, that's our study 3 weeks from tonight. They become the next empire. And what's interesting is in 161 BC, or excuse me, 141 BC, the leader of the Maccabees makes the first treaty with the Romans. It's the first time ever that the Jews have contact with the Romans, and Judas Maccabeus makes a treaty with them. This is the beginning of Roman influence in the region. But in 146 BC, two things happened. The Romans defeat Carthage, which is a great city on the northern African coast. And in that same year, Corinth, the great Greek city, falls to Rome. And what you have is the Romans. Look how far west they are. Look at where we're talking about here, Jerusalem in the Mediterranean. Here's Athens. There's Turkey. Persia's over here. Here's Rome. Here's Carthage. You've got Rome moving this direction. And by the time Jesus is born, Rome rules the world. In fact, it was said when Jesus was born that all roads lead to Rome. But all the Romans spoke Greek. And of course, the Roman leader, Mark Antony, fell in love with the last queen of the Ptolemaic Empire, who by this time was just a province of Rome. Her name was Cleopatra. And they had an alliance with a guy by the name of King Herod. And in 4 weeks, I will show you how Mark Antony, the Roman ruler, Cleopatra, King Herod, come against a man who becomes the first Caesar of the Roman Empire. He took the name Augustus Caesar, and he's the one you read about where it says, in the days of Augustus Caesar, a decree went out that all the world should be taxed. You see, we have come to the time when the Messiah comes, and he is born during Roman rule. So what you have in Scripture is the Assyrian Empire, the Babylonian Empire. You read about those two empires in your Old Testament. But then you've got the rise of the Greek Empire. Then you've got the rise of the Roman Empire. The Persian Empire conquered the Babylonians. You'll read about them in the Old Testament. Those first three empires. But the Greek Empire and the Roman Empire. You'll only read about the Roman Empire in the New Testament. How did they form? What happened? This is where we will continue for the next few weeks as we look at the time between the Testaments. Okay. Yes, sir.
Okay. Can you repeat this again? You said the study of Artemis worship is key to our understanding.
Yes. The question is, would you repeat something? We'll do this. We'll make this the only question. An understanding of Artemis worship is a key to understanding Ephesians and Timothy. And I'll give you an example of this. Okay? In Artemis worship, the women ruled. I'd show you a picture of Artemis. She was like this, sword, and all the men cowed to her. She was the god of the hunt and the goddess of fertility. They ruled, they spoke, they dominated men. And in Ephesus, all the women wanted to be like Artemis. They dominated men. And there was a convert to Jesus who had come out of the Artemis cult, who was a woman who was used to ruling men. And she came into the church and she was telling men what to do and all that stuff. And Paul, Timothy writes to Paul and says, "What do I do?" And Paul writes back and he says, "You tell that woman that she needs to be quiet." And today, Southern Baptists take that verse and say, across the board, every single woman needs to keep their mouth shut in church. Hey, amen. I heard that. Amen. David, yeah, there we go. I see your wife behind you like that. I love it. So, that's why when people say to me, "Wait, how can you say that there's equality of men and women in the New Testament?" I'll tell you how I say it, because I understand history. And I understand Artemis worship. And I understand the problems in Ephesus. And I understand what Paul is being asked by Timothy. Make sense? Oh, I'm sorry. I get too passionate. I need to quit that. We're done. Question? No, he did not. That's a great question. Alexander the Great had no heirs. Some people believe that he was not fertile. He had no heirs. That's why he was divided among the generals. Great question. Y'all listen well. See you next week for the Maccabean Revolt.